and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, May 27. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. Why don't we start with a look at the front page of today's Courier. The first headline on the front page reads, Biggest Impacts of 2021 Session. The second article with a photo feature says, Let Good Times Roll. Third article reads, Herrera named provost at UNI. And the last article on the front page, headline reads, Murder suspect blames mystery men for runners slaying. And we will jump into the first article headline that read, Biggest Impacts of 2021 Session. Penned by Meg McMillan, Dateline, Des Moines. State lawmakers approved nearly 200 pieces of legislation during the recently closed 2021 session of Iowa legislature. Here are some of the bills that figure to have the most significant impacts on Iowans. All of the bills have been passed by the Iowa legislature. Some have been signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds. Others await her decision. Permitless carry. What the bill does, eliminates the requirement that Iowans obtain a permit to acquire or carry firearms. What they said. Currently, whether we want to admit it or not, our system of permits is one of mistrust. That means you can exercise a fundamental right, but you must prove yourself not guilty in advance. That is a quote from Representative Jason Schultz, Republican in Schleswig. Status. House File 756 was signed into law April 2nd. Driver's Education. What the bill does. Eliminates the requirement that teenagers apply for a driver's license, accumulate practice driving hours with a licensed instructor. This essentially clears the way for parents to teach their children how to drive. Teenagers still must complete a final test with a certified instructor before obtaining a driver's license. What they said. To say that this proposed legislation might be a bad idea is a monumental understatement. That's a quote by Rob Rain, a driving instructor from Iowa Western Community College in Council Bluffs. The status is Senate File 546 was signed into law May 10. Charter schools, what the bill does. Expands Iowa's public charter school program by allowing a charter school to establish without the approval of the local school board as currently required. What they said. The bill gives local public school boards a chance to be inactive and instrumental delivery, and creates a path for parents to have a hand in defining and creating the optimal public school learning environment for their child. That is a quote from Senator Amy Sinclair, Republican, Allerton. Status, House File 813 was signed into law May 19. Early voting, what the bill does. A sweeping elections bill did many things, but the biggest is a reduction in the amount of time for early voting. The bill reduces the state's early voting period to 20 days and requires ballots returned by mail be received by election day. Until 2 years ago, the early voting period was 40 days and a mailed ballot could be received within a week of the election if it included a postmark that showed it was mailed by election day. What they said. Iowa has clean, fair elections. This bill is passed on lies and makes it harder for Iowans to vote. We should be making it easier for Iowans to vote. That is a quote by Representative Sharon Steckman, Democrat, Mason City. Status, Senate File 413 was signed into law March 8. Internet access. What the bill does. Expands broadband internet access by dedicating $100 million to a grant program designed to incentivize internet companies to expand the high-speed internet to underserved areas. What they said: the bill will transform our infrastructure into a powerful network, enabled fast, high-quality connectivity statewide, and opening doors to new opportunities for communities large and small. That is a quote by Governor Kim Reynolds. Status: House File 867 was signed into law May 24. Housing vouchers. What the bill does: allows landlords to reject low-income tenants who use Section 8 voucher program, essentially ending local policies that, in an attempt to prevent discrimination, required landlords to accept the vouchers. What they said: this bill is a mean-spirited attack on low-income people with disabilities, veterans, and minorities. That is a quote from Marion Civil Rights Commissioner member Brett Niles. Income tax cuts. What the bill does: eliminates guardrails put in place to delay state income tax reductions until state revenue grows at a certain level. Essentially, the bill guarantees the tax cuts will be enacted in 2023, regardless of revenue growth. What they said: not only is this something big and something bold, this is something we can take back to our constituents and say we did something fair, something right, something good. That is a quote from Senator Dan Dawson, Republican, Council Bluffs. Status: Senate File 619 has not yet been signed into law. And on to our next article, which the headline reads, "Let the Good Times Roll," penned by Melody Parker. 4th Street Cruise returns to downtown Waterloo on Saturday. Dateline Waterloo. Rev your engines, crank up your radios, and get ready to roll. The 105.7 KOKZ 4th Street Cruise is returning to downtown Waterloo on Saturday. The 39th cruise is from noon to 4 p.m. This year's theme is Let 'em Shine, Cruise 39. Admission is free. After last year's miss because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the public is ready to enjoy summer's unofficial kickoff, said Jim Koch, 4th Street Cruise Committee chairman. He is hoping for a sunny day. We're expecting the largest crowd we've seen in a long time. People are excited and eager to get out and to do something fun after a year we've all had. I feel really good about the turnout this year. We think of the cruise as one of the first events of the summer, and it's a holiday weekend too, said Koch, who has chaired the event for the last 15 years. There is no registration or fee. Simply show up with your classic car or truck, street legal and licensed, with a valid driver's license and a vehicle registration. Keith McKeon is pretty sure onlookers will notice his 1959 Chevy Apache fleet side truck Saturday. It's solar yellow. You'll see me coming, said the Cedar Rapids classic car enthusiast. The short bed classic truck is featured on KOKZ's 2021 cruise poster and promotions. It's only McKeon's second cruise. His truck impressed the cruise committee during his first run in 2019. Each year, the committee singles out two classic rides to feature in the next year's advertising. I was pretty honored to get the invite. I built this truck myself. There's really not much that is technically stock about the truck any longer. It's about 4 inches off the ground, and it has a 69 Camaro front suspension fabricated into it. And you can't miss that color, he said. Staging is under the U.S. Highway 218 overpass. The cruise starts at City Hall on Mulberry Street, then the route follows 4th Street across the Cedar River to Bluff Street, Bluff Street to Park Avenue, Park Avenue to Mulberry Street, and Mulberry Street back to 4th Street. Food trucks will be set up along the route, and the downtown restaurants, bars, and shops will be open for business. Events like this are good for the community. It brings people downtown so they can see what has been happening. There has been some good, positive changes, and the cruise is a good chance to show them off, Koch explained. Enthusiasm is quality high for Friday's show and shine from 5 to 9 p.m. at the National Cattle Congress grounds. Admission is free. Jim McKenzie of Waverly will be showing off his Burnt Apple Red 37 Chevy Coupe, also featured on the KOKZ poster. The whole weekend is fun. Friday night is such a big event anymore. You can mingle around and really look at the cars, then you get to the cruise itself. And that's got to be a great thing for the community, how many people it draws, said McKenzie. Based on previous attendance, Koch agreed that it would be a really big event, and we have a lot of people coming from outside the community and from 6 to 8 different states. 2 years ago, at the last Show and Shine, we were just shy of 1,000 show cars. Those attendance figures are totally different than the cruise because some people just want to see the cars. It brings people back into Waterloo, just like the cruise. Koch said it was a pretty easy decision to have the cruise this year. It was more difficult to cancel it last year. That was hard. Now people are thinking about getting events going again and enjoying summer. Things are starting to move forward. We really had a lot of conversations about getting out and getting ready safely. Hopefully everything will be fine. We don't want to go through another year like last year, he added. The article features a photo and the caption reads, "The 37th Annual 4th Street Cruise rumbles through downtown Waterloo in May 2018. The photo features a bright red car, I don't know what kind, coming at us. And then driving away are several bright colored cars, all of different eras, makes, and models." Turning over to our next story, the article headline reads, "Herrera named provost at UNI," penned by Courier staff. Dateline Cedar Falls. Jose Herrera will serve as the University of Northern Iowa's next provost and executive vice president for academic affairs, pending Board of Regents approval, the university announced Wednesday. Herrera is a seasoned higher education academic affairs leader with more than 30 years of experience in teaching, research, and administration. He was chosen from among 4 finalists for the position at UNI, which had a fall enrollment of 9,522 students. He has served as provost and vice president for academic affairs at Mercy College, a 10,000-student private institution in Dobbs Ferry, New York, since 2017. Previously, he held academic affairs leadership roles at Western New Mexico University and Missouri's Truman State University, and was program director for the Division of Undergraduate Education at the National Science Foundation in Arlington, Virginia. Herrera is a Chicago native who began his higher education career as a biology professor. He received a doctorate from Kansas State University, a master's and bachelor's degree in biological sciences from Northern Illinois University, an executive author and lecturer on varying environmental sciences themes. His experience also includes researching and advising on the challenges and importance of first-generation college students and minority-serving institutions. Dr. Herrera brings an impressive combination of scholarly rigor and administrative expertise that will help UNI further deliver on its mission of academic excellence and student success, UNI President Mark Nook said in a news release. "We were fortunate to attract a large pool of extremely qualified candidates during this national search, and we are looking forward to welcoming Dr. Herrera and his family to the University of Northern Iowa and Cedar Valley community." Herrera visited the university and interviewed for the position virtually May 3 and 4. Other finalists included Vandana Kohli, California State University, Channel Islands, College of Arts and Sciences, Dean Kelly Burke, University of North Carolina, Greensboro Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, and Dean of Graduate College, and Brenda Bass, UNI Dean of College of School and Behavioral Sciences. More than 80 applications were submitted for the position, with 8 semifinalists initially chosen. Herrera steps into the critical position at the pivotal time in UNI's history. As the university approaches its 150th anniversary, it is focused on growing academic and outreach programs to serve the state for the next quarter century. I'm excited to contribute to a community and a state that values learning and academic excellence for all its students, Herrera said. I look forward to serving UNI, the Cedar Valley, and the state of Iowa to make these communities even better. Herrera and his wife Becky have 3 children, Lincoln, Cleo, and Samuel. The family plans to relocate to the Cedar Valley this summer. Herrera will begin his new role on Monday, July 12. Patrick Pace, Associate Provost for the Academic Affairs and Professor of Geology, will serve as Interim Provost from June 1 until Herrera's arrival in July. The transition comes after Jim Hualpert announced his resignation in January as UNI Provost to lead Central Washington University. The article features a photo of Dr. Herrera, and also a second photo of a student posing in front of a mural on campus. On to the final front page article headline, which reads, "Murder Suspect Blames Mystery Men for Runner's Murder," penned by Ryan Joe Foley of the Associated Press. Dateline, Iowa City. The man on trial for the 2018 abduction and stabbing death of a University of Iowa student claimed for the first time Wednesday that 2 masked men were responsible for the crime but forced him to take part at gunpoint. In a surprise development, the defense called Christian Benea Rivera as a witness at his first-degree murder trial. He admitted that his black car was the one on the surveillance video circling Molly Tibbetts while she was jogging in Brooklyn, Iowa, on July 18, 2018. He also acknowledged that she ended up in his car's trunk, that he hid her body in a cornfield, and that he told investigators where to find it a month later. But the farm laborer presented a far different narrative about what happened when prosecutors did, denying that he was responsible for the stab wounds on Tibbetts' head, neck, chest that caused her death. Benea Rivera said 2 armed men who were wearing black and had their faces covered by stocking caps showed up at his trailer after he finished showering that evening. The men directed him to get in his car and drive, and they passed Tibbetts as she ran several times before directing him to stop, he said. Benea Rivera, 26, said a man with a knife got out of the car and walked down to the rural road. The man was gone for about 10 minutes, and the second man in the back seat of the car grew nervous, saying, "Come on, Jack," he claimed. The defendant said he didn't know the men's identity, but his lawyers have tried to raise suspicion about Tibbetts' boyfriend, Dalton Jack, who admitted to an affair with another woman and past anger problems. Police said they cleared Jack as a suspect after establishing he was out of town for work that day. Benea Rivera said the men loaded something into his truck, directed him to drive several miles to a rural area, turn off the car, wait a few minutes, and leave. They said they knew his ex-girlfriend and young daughter, and that they would harm them if he ever told anyone what happened, he said. Benea Rivera said the men took off on foot down the road and he never saw them again. He said he opened the trunk a few minutes later and found Tibbetts' body, which he said was heavy as he carried it to the cornfield. He said he covered her body in corn stalks because I didn't want her to be exposed to the sun, and that he then left and never planned to discuss what had happened again. Bonilla Rivera said he left Tybalt's phone, Fitbit, and earbuds on the side of the road. Bonilla Rivera said he wasn't truthful when detectives began questioning him about Tybalt's disappearance on August 20th, 2018, because he was worried about his daughter's safety. Back then, he said he had approached Tybalt as he ran, fought with her after she threatened to call the police, then blacked out before hiding her body. He said he agreed to lead investigators to Tybalt's body early the next day because he was tired and wanted the interrogation to end. And he said police had urged him to put myself in the family's position and to think of how he would feel if his daughter was missing. Bonilla Rivera recounted growing up poor in southern Mexico and illegally coming to the U.S. after he turned 17, crossing a river into Texas on an inflatable raft with about 10 other people. He immediately went to live in Iowa, where his father's brother had settled, and got a job within days milking cows at a dairy farm, he said. Bonilla Rivera, who has been jailed since August 2018's arrest, said he worked 12-hour days and was careful to avoid police for fear of deportation. He said he never had contact with law enforcement until investigators looking into Tybalt's disappearance identified his vehicle on a homeowner's surveillance video on her running route. Most legal experts had not expected Bonilla Rivera to testify. His lawyers, Chase Freeze, said during jury selection that he was torn on whether to call his client as a witness. He said that if Bonilla Rivera didn't testify, it would look like he had something to hide, but if he did, he might be seen as trying to save himself. Jurors perked up when Bonilla Rivera took to the witness stand, and prosecutors furiously took notes while he testified. Bonilla Rivera showed little emotion, but his voice dropped and slightly trembled as he discussed the men's alleged threats to his daughter. The defense rested its case later Wednesday, closing arguments in the week-long trial at Scott County Courthouse in Davenport were scheduled for Thursday. Bonilla Rivera faces life in prison if he is convicted. Now on to some more local news. Our next headline reads, Building Smiles, Waterloo Man Makes Furniture for Toddlers, penned by Kristen Guess. Dateline Waterloo. With more time on his hands working remotely during the pandemic and sharing custody of his daughter during a divorce, Darren Adams was looking for a healthy distraction. So he dove into one of his hobbies, woodworking. He began by building a picnic table for his 4-year-old daughter. She absolutely loved it, he said. So he wanted to do more. He began advertising the toddler tables on Facebook and shocked at the response. There was a lot more interest than I thought there would be, he said. Before he could respond, he had more than 200 comments from interested Facebook users. I wanted something to consume my free time to make them happy because I was not the happiest at that time, he said. Now he's averaging about 25 hours per week in his garage building furniture to make children happy. It's kind of like a part-time job almost, except I don't make any money, he said. Even the proceeds goes towards making others happy. He is giving all the profits to the House of Hope in Waterloo, a nonprofit organization that helps homeless single mother families and women ages 18 to 24 who age out of foster care. This year, Adam gave the House of Hope $180 and 2 toddler tables. They were really excited about it, he said, especially the tables. They do a lot of work for kids, too. With plenty of lumber on hand and a passion for helping others, Adams created the Treasure for Tots page on Facebook for those interested in purchasing toddler tables or chairs or donating to local charities that contribute to the global good. Adams has nailed down an effective system for building. It takes him 15 minutes to build a table. Over time, I've learned how to make stops and jigs so I can make them faster. It cuts down on construction time so I can build more, he said. Adams is serious about spreading joy. He has altered his table's designs for specific requests, including a design to accommodate a child in a wheelchair. The picnic table cost nearly twice the price to build and took more than he typically spends on a table, but he charged the same as any other table. This is supposed to be open to everybody. When you do something for fun, you do it for fun, he said. Adams is prepared to build more furniture, but he's sticking to his customer base. I only build stuff for toddlers because kids are always happy. If you do build a chair that's just for them, they're not going to complain. They're so happy because they have a table built just for them, he said. With lumber prices soaring, Adam charges $55 for a painted picnic table and $45 for unpainted. Chairs cost $45 for painted and $35 for unpainted. Adam said he intentionally keeps his prices at a fraction of what online stores Amazon charges. Then, less people would be able to buy them and less kids would be happy, and that wouldn't serve its purpose, he said. This year, Adam is spreading the joy to animals as well. He's building catios, cat patios, and donating proceeds to the Black Hawk Wildlife Rehabilitation Project. He chooses the animal rehab project because they recently helped him rescue a baby owl he named Howlett. About 3 years ago, Adams discovered his yard in Cedar Terrace neighborhood is also home to a family of barned owls. Each year, Mr. and Mrs. Hootie, as Adam refers to the parents, return to a tree in his yard to build a nest for their baby owls, Hootlets. I have a toddler, so I have to make this stuff fun, funny, and cute, he said. This year, one of the Hootlets didn't make its first flight with his two siblings. Instead, the baby fell out of the tree and landed in the grass. The Hootlet was taken to Black Hawk Wildlife and is undergoing rehabilitation. Owls are acrimonious hatchers, which means they don't hatch all at once, but this guy is weeks behind his two siblings. We have never seen such a difference in ages in one nest, the Rescue Project's Facebook page states. If demand remains, Adam said he'll donate proceeds to a different local charity each year. I'm not done yet. There's still a lot more smiles to be made, he said. Next article reads, Hazmat Team Handles Chem Leak at Waterloo Pool, penned by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline, Waterloo. Waterloo firefighters handled a chemical spill at a city recreational pool Wednesday. A maintenance worker discovered a hydrochloric acid leak at the Gates Park Pool, 620 East Donald Street, on Wednesday morning. The leak apparently happened when a pump failed inside a pump house on the south side of the property. It was pretty isolated from the neighborhood, so there wasn't any danger to the neighborhood, said Battalion Chief Ben Peterson with Waterloo Fire and Rescue. Members of the fire department's hazardous materials team suited up in protective gear to clean up the chemical, Peterson said. He characterized this spill as a small leak. This year's swimming season is tentatively set to begin June 5, according to the pool's website. You are listening to a reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, May 27 on Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. From Boiling Brook, Emery Lewis Kaufman, age 29, of Boiling Brook, Illinois, passed away Saturday, May 22, 2021, in Boiling Brook. Emery was born in Waverly, Iowa. He graduated from Plainfield High School in 1948 and was well known on the basketball court as Jumping Jack. He worked at Thiessen and Crescent Electric before working at General Electric for 36 years. M was the manager of training for the U.S. Central Division. He helped with writing manuals and solved design problems with air conditioner units that stumped fellow engineers. Emery was the beloved husband of Jan, loving father to the late Ron, Doug, Linda, Anderson, Jeff, and Mark, and the late father of infant son Joseph. He was the cherished grandpa of 13 grandchildren, dear great-granddad of 15 great-children, and fond uncle of many nieces and nephews. A memorial visitation will be held on Friday, June 4, 2021, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Waverly. Interment will be held at Horton Cemetery in Horton, Iowa, immediately following the visitation. Online condolences can be left online at kaisercorson.com. From Cedar Falls, William Ward Ferris, 77, of Cedar Falls, passed away Tuesday, May 25, 2021, at Mercy One Sartoy Memorial Hospital in Cedar Falls. A funeral liturgy will be held on Saturday, May 29, 2021, at 3 p.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Tama, with Deacon Stan Umpa officiating. Interment will follow at Woodlawn Cemetery in Toledo. Visitation will be held Saturday, May 29, 2021, from 2 to 3 p.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Church prior to the service. William was born on November 24, 1943, in Toledo, Iowa, the son of Ronald and Marjorie Ferris. William graduated from Toledo High School in the class of 1961 and from the State College of Iowa, which is now the University of Northern Iowa. On January 30, 1965, he was united in marriage to Carol Bocher at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Tama. William was a high school teacher and taught social studies, history, and psychology with most of his career in Cedar Falls. He cherished his career as curriculum director at BGM, retiring in 2008. William was a member of Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Waterloo. He enjoyed reading, history, and discussing politics. He loved nature, spending time at the George White State Park, and feeding birds and squirrels. Survivors include his wife of 56 years, Carol of Cedar Falls, three children, Mary Ferris of Waterloo, Matthew Ferris of Chicago, Illinois, and Catherine McGinnis of Iowa City. Three grandchildren, Andrew Ferris of Cedar Falls, Martin Ferris of Schaumburg, Illinois, and Elizabeth Ferris of Schaumburg, Illinois. Two siblings, Ronald John Ferris of Maryville, Missouri, and Daniel Joseph Ferris of Toledo, and several nieces and nephews. Preceding him in death were his parents. Memorials can be directed to the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Waterloo, or charity of choice. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo, is assisting the family with arrangements. From Shell Rock, Doris Louise Dilger, 64, of Shell Rock, died Tuesday, May 25, 2021, at Mercy One Covenant Medical Center in Waterloo, Iowa. Doris was born November 1, 1956, in Waverly, Iowa, the daughter of Vern and Gertrude Wubnea. She graduated from Waverly High School with a class of 1975. On June 17, 1978, she was united in marriage to Don Dilger at the Episcopal Church in Waterloo. Doris worked as a rural carrier for the Waterloo Courier for 35 years and most recently was employed by Waverly Shell Rock Schools in the kitchen, a job she thoroughly enjoyed. Doris loved the acreage and the hill that she and John lived on in Shell Rock. She enjoyed raising chickens and being outdoors. She also enjoyed working on various sewing projects. Going out to eat was a highlight for Doris, especially to her favorite place in Shell Rock, the Riverview Restaurant. Doris is survived by her husband, John of Shell Rock, 3 children, Anita Quinton of Belmont, Amber O'Neill of Rockwell City, and Justin Dilger of Shell Rock, 8 grandchildren, 1 brother, Dwayne Wubna of Minnesota, 3 sisters-in-law, 1 brother-in-law, Steve Dilger, and sister-in-law Karen Wubna. She is preceded in death by her parents, a brother, Roger Wubnaya. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, May 29, 2021, at Faith Lutheran Church in Shell Rock with Pastor Kim Smith officiating. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday, May 28, 2021, at the Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Shell Rock, and for an hour prior to the services at the church on Saturday. Memorials can be directed to the family, and online condolences can be left at kaisercorson.com. Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Shell Rock is in charge of the arrangements. From Waterloo, Ryan Gregory Kent, 38, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, May 25, 2021, at University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics, Iowa City. He was born October 15, 1982, in Waterloo, son of Gregory and Arvella Kent, married Valerie Brignard Davis, and later separated. Ryan served our country honorably with both the U.S. Marines and U.S. Army. Survivors include his parents of Waterloo, his son, Ryan Kent Jr., and his daughter, Riley Kent, both of Waterloo, 2 brothers, Philip Kent of Kenosha, Iowa, and Taylor Kent of Waterloo, and his maternal grandmother, Doris Lewerk of Britt, preceded in death by his paternal grandparents, Gilbert and Beatrice Kent, and maternal grandfather, Pete Lewerker. A memorial service will be 10:30 on Saturday at Haggerty Wyckoff Gorp Funeral Service on West Ridgeway, where the family will receive friends 1 hour before service. Military honors will be conducted by Emmett's Post 3-1 and the Iowa Army Honor Guard. Memorials to be directed to the family. From Cedar Falls, Irene Ruth Raub, age 91, died on Monday, May 24, 2021, at the Western Home in Cedar Falls. She was born March 1, 1930, in Benton County, Iowa, the daughter of Albert and Ruth Walding. She graduated from Belle Plaine High School in 1947. Irene married Richard Raub in August 27, 1950, in Dystart. He died on September 25, 2003. Richard and Irene farmed the family farm south of Dystart until their retirement in 1981, when they moved to town. She was also a homemaker. Irene enjoyed baking, gardening, playing cards, especially 500 and bridge, and helping tough on the farm. She was a member of the Dystart United Methodist Church, the Dystart Women's Club, and the Dystart Country Club. Irene is preceded in death by her parents, her husband Richard, and all her 7 siblings, and a great-grandson, Austin. She is survived by her children, Larry Raub of Aurora, Colorado, and Patricia Jans of Brooklyn, Iowa, 4 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren. A private family burial will take place at the Dystart Cemetery at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, May 26, 2021, with a private family service being held at the Dystart United Methodist Church on June 1, 2021, at 6 p.m. The family would like to give a special thank you to the Western Home Communities at St. Croix Hospice for caring for Irene. Memorials may be directed to the family. Overton Funeral Home Dystart is handling arrangements. Condolences may be left at overtonfuneralhomes.com. That wraps up for the obituaries. Why don't we go to the opinion section now? The first opinion article reads, Commentary, the Republican Party's New McCarthyism. This is by Robert A. George. Forgive Americans if they no longer remember the elephant is the symbol of the Republican Party. Elephants are supposed to never forget. Yet Republicans seem more than happy to memory hole the January 6th U.S. Capitol riot, as GOP members of Congress find absurd reasons to oppose a bipartisan commission to examine the beginnings and unfolding of an attempt to upend a presidential election. It's yet another aspect of the party's service to a former president insistent on warping the facts of the general election he refuses to admit he lost, and it's yet another piece of evidence that the party itself shares his delusion. Call this affliction the new McCarthyism, after House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. He first forced out Liz Cheney, the number three Republican, who pointedly refuses to go along with Donald Trump's nonsense. Then he performed a flip-flop for the ages. McCarthy assigned Representative John Katko of New York to negotiate the nature of the commission, a 10-person panel equally divided between out-of-office politicians of both parties. Katko gave McCarthy precisely what he wanted, which turned out not to be enough. Separately, McCarthy stood by as members such as Andrew Clyde of Georgia claimed that it was a lie to call the January 6th riot an insurrection because, in fact, it was not too dissimilar from a normal tourist visit of the Capitol. Shortly afterward, a journalist retweeted a photo of Clyde helping to barricade the doors to the White House floor, attempting to keep out the invading hordes. It's all but certain that McCarthy is doing this because he fears personal exposure. In the days before the attack, McCarthy told other Republicans that he had a tense call with the White House on January 6th, in which he urged Trump to call off the assault on the Capitol. 1 week later, he said on the White House floor, "The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress mob by rioters." Since then, McCarthy has been all in on getting back into Trump's good graces. McCarthy's flip-flop may have inspired his Senate counterpart, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, to do his own. This is the same man who gives one of the most devastating rhetorical takedowns of Trump at the impeachment trial, even as he voted to acquit. There is no question that President Trump is partially and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day, he declared on February 13. McConnell now deems the House bill, which remarkably still got 35 Republican votes, slanted and unbalanced, even though it was a negotiated compromise. Approving such a process would apparently get in the way of the GOP's midterm message, and also senators such as Mike Rounds of South Dakota supported the commission on one day but opposed it the next. Even senators who voted to convict Trump in his February impeachment trial, such as Richard Burr of North Carolina, deemed the commission unnecessary. It is everything but, yes, there are other inquiries into the events of that day, but there are many questions that won't be answered by prosecutors of the insurrectionists. Precisely what did Trump to tell McCarthy when Republican leader pleaded for the president to get his supporters to stand down? Why wasn't the National Guard promptly activated? How aware was the president that his vice president was in imminent harm's way? Why did it take hours for the president to record a video to his supporters storming the Capitol? Why did he still advocate their violent behavior with another affirmation that the election was fraudulent and that he loved them? Did any members of Congress encourage the rioters? Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vows a vote on the commission as early as this week. If Republicans block that vote, perhaps the Democrats should adopt the stubbornness of the donkey that has long been their symbol and force the Republicans to defend on the Senate floor why they would prefer not to explore the events of January 6. If Republicans want to block an official inquiry into an unprecedented insurrection, let them pay the public political price. After which, if Senate Republicans succeed in wielding the filibuster to kill the commission, the Democrats will have no choice from a select congressional committee and pursue the truth. To ignore the roots of the insurrection would be to further encourage the ongoing anti-democratic behavior of Trump partisans across the country and guarantee that future assaults are all but inevitable. Our next opinion comes from Trudy Rubin. It's headlined, "Punish Belarus Leader for Ryanair Hijacking." Imagine you're flying over Europe in a European air carrier on your way home from a Greek vacation in the post-coronavirus era. Suddenly, your plane does a 180-degree turn and lands in Minsk, Belarus. You see from your window that it is being escorted by an MiG-29 fighter jet. You are held for 7 hours at the Minsk airport while an exiled Belarusian dissident and his girlfriend are seized from among the passengers and hustled off by security police. This act of air piracy was not a movie plot or the work of Middle East terrorists. It took place Saturday when an Irish-owned Ryanair passenger jet flying from Greece to Lithuania was forced, on direct orders from Belarusian strongman President Alexander Lukashenko, to land in Minsk as it crossed through Belarusian airspace. The goal was to kidnap prominent Belarusian journalist Roman Protasevich, 26, who has been living in exile in Lithuania and was flying home. In other words, Lukashenko thinks he can carry out a political hijacking in a European country, and a neighboring Russia is openly supporting this crime. If Lukashenko gets away with this state-supported hijacking, the term used by Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary, and future flight might be taken down for political reasons while flying over Russian, Chinese, or Aryan airspace. This would be one more step toward the ongoing breakdown of the most basic international norms by authoritarian leaders who want to play by their own rules. Already, Russia's Vladimir Putin has succeeded in annexing neighboring Ukraine's territory in Crimea, the first such territory seized by force in Europe since World War II. Meantime, Russia is nibbling at territory across the border in India and Bhutan and has blatantly grabbed inlets in the South China Sea claimed by multiple countries, and Putin has used banned nerve agents to poison Russian dissidents in Britain, as well as his leading opponent, Alexei Navalny. What makes these violations of international law even more egregious is that Beijing and Moscow brazenly deny them or dismiss them. Western sanctions haven't worked. Lukashenko issued a transparent fiction about a bomb threat to the Ryanair flight, but Ryanair's O'Leary believes there were Belarusian KGB agents on the flight who had been following Predovich from Athens, Greece. There was also a massive security presence on the ground to grab him as he disembarked. Also, as that in Russia, the hijacking was cheered by Putin backers. So, the question facing NATO nations is what kind of punishment will grab Lukashenko's attention, and more importantly, that of Putin? It's hard to believe Lukashenko would have seized the airliner without at least a Kremlin green light, despite Russian denials. Sandwiched between Russia in the east and NATO members to the west and northwest, Lukashenko looks to Putin for his lifeline, and the Russian leader wants to pull former Soviet states like Belarus back into its orbit. So the response to Lukashenko's crime must be significantly strong to capture Putin's attention as well. Stunned by the hijacking, the European Union quickly agreed EU airlines from flying over Belarus and banned Belarusian airlines from landing at its airports or flying over its airspace. But isolating Belarus, while necessary, will hit ordinary citizens the hardest. The EU also promised to impose new sanctions on Belarus. Hopefully, these will be aimed at the big state-owned companies that keep Lukashenko's government afloat. Yet, the EU and the Biden administration must not forget that behind the Belarusian despot stands Putin. Even with all we have done, we haven't really changed Putin's behavior, says Alexander Rechbau, former U.S. ambassador to Moscow and the deputy secretary general of NATO. And Putin has no interest in current international norms. So, to prevent air piracy from becoming new tools of dictators, NATO members must make Lukashenko pay a high enough price and release Protasevich. And the price must be that one that will force Putin to take notice. If Biden doesn't galvanize NATO members, no one else will, says Vereshbow. Joe Biden will meet Putin for a June 16 summit in Geneva, and the hijacking should be top of his agenda. Otherwise, state-sponsored air piracy may become a new international norm. With the time that we have left, why don't we dig into some sports news? First up is Metro Baseball Tournament. The headline reads, West wins thriller over Cedar Falls in Metro Baseball Final, penned by Jim Nelson. Dateline Waterloo. It was a pitch-perfect scenario for Waterloo West head baseball coach Nate Lamphor. With his fast run on the second base as the potential winning run, Lamphor also had his best hitter coming to the plate in Mitch Fordyce. With one out in the bottom of the seventh in a tie game of the Metro Baseball Tournament Championship game, Wednesday at Riverfront Stadium, Fordyce delivered exactly what Lamphor expected. Fordyce, running line dive down the right field line that drove home Colby Adams from second base to lift the Warhawks to a 4-3 victory over number 9 Cedar Falls to cap off a tight ball game between the two rivals. We were preaching to Mitch in the fifth that he was going to get another shot and it was going to be to win the game, Lamphor said. That definitely was the situation we wanted him in. He went with the pitch and hit it hard where it was pitched. Adams left off the seventh with a shot between third and a shot to reach with a single. Luke Fordyce moved him to second with a sacrifice bunt down the first baseline before the Tigers chose to intentionally walk Carter Shuttle to set up a potential double play. But Fordyce, who hit two home runs in West's semifinal win over Columbus on Monday, had only one thing on his mind. Colby was on second, and he was really fast, so I just wanted to put the ball in play, Fordyce said. I've worked on that the last couple of years, taking the ball the other way, and it paid off in that at-bat. Cedar Falls got the jump on West in the first as West starter Luke Fordyce struggled with control, walking three batters. With two outs, Caleb Reiste followed a deep fly down the right field line, just eluded the driving attempt by Warhawk right fielder Clayton Rittinghouse to catch it soaring a pair of runners. Designated hitter Brian Braden Smith made it 3-0 with a single to the center. Fordyce settled in after his rough first and retired the final nine batters he faced in order. He was relieved by Sam Moore, who struck out the first five batters he faced and six altogether with the final three innings to pick up the win. Our plan was to come in and have Luke start, Limfer said. We would have liked him to go longer, but he got up there and pitches. The situation arose where Sam could come in, and I tell you what, they both did a phenomenal job. West got back in the second, taking advantage of a pair of Tiger errors, and then a two-out error in the third extended the Warhawks' inning, and Mitch Fordyce scored on Sam Moore's infield single. The message Cedar Falls had, Coach Barrett Williams had to his team after, was they had to do the little things better. And that does it for the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, May 27. I'm your reader, Maddie Ryan. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And as always, thank you so much for listening.